Sean Talbot. And Dr. Sean Talbot received his master's degree in exercise science from the University of Massachusetts and his PhD in nutritional biochemistry from Rutgers. He is the author of 11 books and a fellow of both the American College of Nutrition and the American College of Sports Medicine. And he also serves as the Chief Science Officer at Monomi. So everybody please welcome Dr. Sean Talbot.
Well, hey everybody, thanks for being here this afternoon. I'm going to talk, it looks like I might have a little font problem, so hopefully it won't be, can you hear me with this microphone? Maybe I need to turn this one on. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right, everybody laughs when you say that, right, because of the Verizon commercials or whatever it is. I think I should point out before I start, though, that they're backloading the Seans in your program. The last four speakers of the day, three of them are named Sean. So I'm your second Sean. You'll get one more right after me. This talk is sponsored by the American College of Nutrition. So ACN and ISSN have a speaker exchange program. You know, so someone from ISSN will come to our annual conference. Somebody from ACN will come to this annual conference. What we're trying to do is get a dialogue going back and forth about a bit about what I'm going to talk about today. The fact that, you know, some of the same nutrition interventions and lifestyle interventions that we'll do to get people to be healthier will be good for athletes, and vice versa. What we get to, you know, what we recommend athletes to do to improve their performance will just, you know, sort of luckily be good for health. And I think you'll see that kind of a theme when I go through and talk about the impact of nutrition on mood state, vigor, and what you can't see, which is behind my beautiful mountains because of some font changes, is physical and mental performance. So a lot about what I'm going to talk about in the next, you know, 40, 45 minutes or so is this concept that we measure called vigor. In psychology research, vigor is the opposite of burnout. And so burnout, for whatever reason, has sort of crossed over from research into the public vocabulary. People will say burnout. They won't say vigor. You know, so everybody knows what burnout is. It's something that we use in sort of normal language. Here's the definition of vigor, though. Three-tiered sustained mood state characterized by physical energy, mental acuity, and emotional well-being. Measuring all those three things together is vigor. We measure those separately, too. We can measure mental focus separately from vigor. We can measure fatigue indexes separately from vigor. We can measure overall quality of life separately from vigor. So vigor is kind of this overall feeling of motivation, actually. You know, it's neat in the studies, and I'll show you some data towards the end of my slides. When you take someone from a state of low vigor or high burnout, depending on how your scale is measuring it, and get them back to a state of normal vigor or high vigor, it literally is life-changing. If they're an athlete, their performance has gone up like crazy, even though their VO2 hasn't changed, their lactate threshold hasn't changed, their you know, their power output hasn't changed. If you can change the psychology and improve their vigor, their performance improves. Likewise with sort of a normal, non-athletic person. If you can take them from a state of low vigor, high burnout, back to a state of high vigor, their motivation comes back. They feel like doing things. You know, they might say that they're not depressed. They might say that they're not fatigued. They might say that the brain fog is gone. And, you know, all of that is just part and parcel of their vigor has improved. And it's a really neat way to do it. I think my slide's advanced. Let me go back. Okay, so here's another way of looking at vigor. This is a word cloud from one of my books, The Secret of Vigor. My 14-year-old daughter was duly impressed that I knew how to make a word cloud on the internet. You basically just take, this keeps changing, that's interesting. It's very touchy, huh? So the size of the word is representative of how often it's used in the text. So you can see vigor is obviously a big discussion. But cortisol goes into a measurement of vigor. Being in balance or out of balance in a lot of different areas of biochemistry goes into a discussion of vigor. Things like inflammation, oxidation, glucose control, sleep levels. You get the idea. It's all about, one of the things that I'm very fond of saying, especially when I do a sort of a public non-scientific presentation when I'm trying to educate a lay audience about this, is that your biochemistry drives your behavior. We were joking around a little bit before about when people have cravings, you know, there might be a reason for that craving. If someone's fatigued or energetic, there's a reason for that biochemically. If somebody is craving sweets, there's a reason for that biochemically. And that, you know, for the people that we counsel, that sometimes is very, very empowering, because they know, oh, I feel this particular way because of something that's going on inside my body. And it empowers them to say, oh, if I eat this way, if I exercise this way, if I sleep this way, if I change my lifestyle in these particular ways, it's going to change something concrete. It's not just in my head. You know, it is in their head, but it's biochemistry that's in their head. It's not that they're imagining it. So a lot of the kind of work that I do is around herbal concoctions, different mushroom extracts, different root extracts, different plant extracts. And the reason that I do that kind of work comes back to this idea. When I'm studying vigor, when I'm studying that psychological mood state from a Western psychological perspective, it's the exact same concept that you can find in virtually any culture around the world. So, you know, you can look at traditional medicine systems, you can look at traditional Chinese medicine, and their word for vigor is very analogous to qi, QI. You know, this idea of life force, this idea of feeling good and not feeling bad, this idea of feeling youthful and energetic and not feeling old and worn out and, you know, sort of broken down. In Ayurvedic medicine, in Indian medicine, it's called prana. If you're a Jedi Knight, you would call it life force, right? You would call it the force. But that idea permeates every single culture. And sometimes when you're looking at an herb, they'll say it's for energy. And really, when you actually do some studies on it, I'll show you some of that data in a little bit, you'll find, hey, wait a minute, the reason it's giving energy is because it's lowering your cortisol levels, or it's raising your testosterone levels, or it's changing the balance between neurotransmitters like serotonin and things like that. So I'll share some of that data as we go through. So here's just a real quick snapshot of some of the relationship between diet and vigor. And you might look at some of these studies and say, you know, did we really need to do that study? One of my favorite ones, let me see if this laser pointer will work. One of my favorite ones is this one. Fast food intake and commercial baked goods. Basically, a diet of French fries and cupcakes increases your risk of depression, right? Did we need to do that study to know that French fries and cupcakes are not good for us long term? Probably not. But, you know, the way that those kinds of things are measured is actually kind of interesting. Mediterranean diet improves quality of life. We heard from Sean Arendt earlier today, we heard some of the great data around omega-3s and potential brain benefits. You know, whether that's brain benefits depression or brain benefits attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, there are a lot of good benefits there where you can basically now start drawing a straight line between some aspect of lifestyle, in this case nutrition, and how the brain is performing or how the person is feeling in an overall quality of life kind of thing. So I'm not going to go through all of these, but just to give you a perspective that data set is growing and growing and growing. And it's funny, I've been doing this kind of work for vigor work for about 10, 11, 12 years, something like that. And when I started doing it, there was a big disconnect. You know, I'd go to an American College of Nutrition meeting, and that meeting has a lot of physicians that come to it. You know, and there was very much an idea of the mind and the body being very separate things. They should be studied separately. They should be treated separately. That they didn't really cross over. And that was only a decade ago. You know, and now clearly that's, you know, I come to a meeting like this, and it's we know that they're very intimately linked. So, you know, I mentioned before, people won't say that their vigor is low. Nobody ever comes in to one of our studies or goes out of one of our studies saying, using that word vigor. They'll say they're tired. They'll say they're stressed. They'll say they're depressed. They'll say that they're blah. And one of the reasons for it is that the prevalence of chronic stress is it defies expression sometimes to actually say how bad it is, right? If you look at it from a statistical perspective, how much of the population, this is U.S., Canada, EU data, but you can really apply this kind of data to any industrialized country, it's a bigger deal bigger problem than the obesity epidemic, right? You know, it's more than the 65 or 69 or 68% of the population that has this problem. If you look at, I'm not going to go through all these bullets. If you look at just the last three bullet points in red, anywhere from 65 to 90% of the population of any industrialized country in the world is going to have enough chronic stress to result in some sort of a health, and in some sort of a stress-related condition, right? A stress-related disease. That disease might be, and there, it changed for me. It might be obesity. It might be depression. It might be immune system dysfunction. It might be diabetes. It might be osteoporosis. I sort of came into this area of looking at how stress, and specifically stress hormones like cortisol, can influence the body, the physical body, through looking at how can the stress of dieting break down your bones faster in osteoporosis. So when I was at Rutgers, our lab was one of the first ones to discover that if you go through the stress of weight cycling, roller coaster dieting, losing weight, gaining weight in cycles, your bone goes away but doesn't come back. And so over the course of several cycles, you're actually putting yourself at risk for osteoporosis down the line. You know, so the fact that something that sort of abstract, right, the stress in your head can change something, make your bones become catabolic, something that's very real and very concrete, I think is important for us to understand. Why does it keep doing that?
It's possessed.
Is it a, all right, I'll just. I'll just go with it. So this is, the numbers here that you can see on this slide are representative of how many PubMed hits there are for that relationship. Some sort of an overstressed situation leading to an imbalance in biochemistry, leading to an outcome, some sort of a physical ailment. So you can see that, you know, depression, anxiety, ADD is huge. There's over 20,000 studies in that area. You can look at something like obesity, about 3,000. Diabetes is around the same, 1,200. Osteoporosis, 3,000. Immune system dysfunction and cancer risk, almost 10,000. So this idea is growing and becoming more solidified in the literature. One of the things that I find really interesting about doing this kind of work is that, you know, you can look at disrupted biochemistry. Let's just say one of the main areas of biochemistry that I'll show you actual data on is the relationship between cortisol levels and testosterone levels. If you look at just cortisol testosterone imbalances, let's just say very generally, high cortisol, low testosterone, that is the same sort of a disruption that you'll see across the board, no matter what the stress is. So that could be an overtrained athlete. It could be somebody who's dieting in an inappropriate way to try to lose weight, like a crash dieter. It could be somebody who's not sleeping enough. A short sleeper would be anybody who gets about 6 hours a night versus 8 hours a night. Do you have any of those in here? Yeah, everybody, right? A whole bunch of hands just went up. And it could be somebody who has this sort of what we might view as a stereotypical stressful situation. You know, psychological stress. You know, they're worrying about bills, they're worried about traffic and deadlines and things like that. But they share the same biochemical disruptions. They have the same psychological outcomes. You'll see that we've been pretty successful in correlating the change in hormones to the change in psychology. So getting back to that biochemistry driving behavior, you know, cortisol changes this percentage. Hey, look, psychology changes that percentage as well, and I'll show you some of that data. But the benefit of that is that once you restore balance to this person, once you get their stress levels down and get them sleeping better and get them eating better and get their cortisols back where they need to be, their psychology benefits as well. And I think what is important about that isn't just that we can make that person feel better, that individual, at that time. That's great, right? Everybody wants to feel better, whether you're an athlete or not. But once you feel better, then you can train harder. Once you feel better, then you're more compliant with that regimen. If you're on a plan that makes you feel better, you're going to stay on that plan, right? That makes a lot of sense. One of the big problems with the kind of work that I think a lot of us do is compliance, right? If the regimen's too hard, if it's too complicated, if it's too difficult to follow, and if it makes us feel we're not going to adhere to it, right? That's one of the big buzzwords in pharma research right now is improving compliance. So the areas of metabolism that I generally look at in the kind of work that I do fall into four buckets of biochemistry or metabolism. So we look at oxidative balance, you know, the balance between free radicals and antioxidants. We look at stress hormone balance, which tends to be the balance between cortisol and testosterone. We look at blood sugar balance, glucose levels across time and insulin levels. And we look at inflammatory balance, the balance between different types of cytokines, inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines. And you know, the general pitch, if you will, when we enroll people in these studies is that if we balance you, if we restore balance in any of those areas, we can improve your vigor. If you're out of balance in any of those areas, your vigor is probably lower than it ought to be. You don't feel quite as good as you could. You know, the holy grail, of course, is to get somebody balanced in all four of those areas at the same time. And certainly, I think we can do that with diet and exercise if we do it the right way. Another way of looking at that same idea is to look at it with the you know, now it's instead of four, now it's three. Looking at free radicals and the diseases that may result from being overexposed to free radicals. You know, cellular damage, DNA damage, mitochondrial dysfunction. Looking at over inflamed states where we're looking at fibromyalgia and allergies and brain dysfunction. Looking at overexposure to cortisol, where we're looking at muscle loss, you know, people being catabolic. We're looking at profound changes in appetite, specifically sweet cravings. We're looking at cortisol interfering with blood sugar and leading possibly to abdominal obesity. So these arrows probably should be bidirectional arrows, two-sided arrows, you know, because if you're overinflamed, that can set off a stress response in the body. If you're overstressed, that can set off an oxidative response in the body. And so it's bad news in several directions, but it's also, once you restore balance, it's good news in several directions at the same time. And I'll show you some data towards the end here, a study where we used a supplement to control cortisol, got good results. We use the supplement to control cytokines, good results, inflammation. And then when we use the two supplements together, we got a true, I hate the word synergy, because in the world of nutrition, synergy is this term that's just thrown around like crazy. But we found a true synergy where we got, you know, not one plus one, one cortisol control, one inflammation control equals two, you know, synergized benefit. We got a, it was like a 4.5 when we actually went back and did the calculations. So they do truly synergize with each other. So this is, I started going down this road before, right? Getting someone to feel better is a win. But the fact that feel better in their life is going to result into some other some better behaviors and some improved compliance is even better. What's particularly scary about somebody being in a situation like this, right? An athlete who's overtrained and starts to become depressed, a mom who's working two jobs and trying to take care of the kids and who is, you know, sliding down that slippery slope into, you know, gaining belly fat and, you know, things like that. That's bad. What's really scary though is the catabolic situation that their entire body is going through. Right, so the mood state changes are sometimes the first signal, right? The first event where you can say, you know what, we need to do something about this person, right? You know, you can, if you have access to it, right, and you can take cortisol measurements and testosterone measurements, and you can measure inflammation, things like that. That's fantastic if you have access to that. But if you only have access to the psychology, there's some very easy, very simple psychological metrics that you can use, some very simple surveys where you can get very, very, very accurate, very reproducible vigor measurements and quality of life measurements and things like that. Because what they're a signal of is this kind of stuff happening in the body. So this is, and I love to show neurons because they're very visual catabolic situation, right? The same thing's happening in muscles and bones and skin and, you know, all kinds of connective tissue throughout the body, ligaments and tendons and things like that, where the scenario is when you're in balance, when you're in a normal stress situation, we have a wonderful looking tissue. So this neuronal body is, it's large, there are a lot of projections there. It just looks, that's a beautiful looking neuron, right? But the one on the right is a terrible looking neuron. It's physically shrunken. It's atrophied, basically. The difference is that, it's become catabolic. Something has caused it to become catabolic and break down faster. And that something is some sort of high stress. That stress could be glucose imbalances. It could be cortisol imbalances. It could be free radical imbalances. It could be cytokine imbalances. It could be lots and lots of different things, but cause that tissue to become catabolic and break down. So, we use that term here at ISSN when we talk about muscles, right? Nobody wants their muscles to become catabolic. But it happens in all of those tissues. It happens in your brain and your bones and your skin and all those tissues, but not this tissue. This is the one tissue that when your cortisol is high and your inflammation is high and all those other things are out of balance, it grows in response to stress, right? So this is probably the scariest slide that I put up for a general audience, where you look at a CT scan of the belly fat region, and you look at a normal stress situation, and the visceral fat, the intra-abdominal fat, has been colorized here, so it's easier to pick out. Not a lot of it, right? They might have their fat in other parts of their body, but they don't have it in their belly region, which is a good thing. Good for their blood pressure, it's good for their cholesterol levels, it's good for their diabetes risk, it's good for their syndrome X. This person, though, high stress situation, high cortisol, high inflammation, high free radicals, poor blood sugar control. Once it gets there, that tissue almost behaves like a tumor, because it starts to create its own environment as a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you might have been high in cortisol or high in any of those other things we talked about, and it made it easier for your body to store belly fat. But now that it's there, it's really hard to get rid of unless you change that biochemistry. So this fat is very metabolically active. It's creating its own free radicals. It's creating its own inflammatory compounds. It's creating its, which will go off into the bloodstream and interfere with your insulin function so that your blood sugar fluctuates. It's creating its own cortisol by activating cortisol that your body has already inactivated, putting it back into its active form so it can store more fat there. It's a really, really scary situation when you actually study what that tissue is doing to perpetuate its own growth. So one anabolic tissue compared to all the other catabolic tissues. So let's talk about what we do when somebody's in that situation. From an elite athlete standpoint, that change in belly fat might be a change from going to, 2% total body fat to 3% total body fat, right? But that's a big change for some of our elite level athletes. Most of the people I talk to would love to be 3% body fat, but it's like their world is ending if you're that level athlete and you've seen that sort of a change. So I love this quote. I don't have an attribution for this. I don't know where I got this. I don't know who said this, but a great diet will not make an average athlete great, but an average diet will make a great athlete average. Right? It's very easy to screw up a good training program with some bad eating behavior. And I want to give you a perspective. So here's some font problems, but I think you can probably still read this. I want to talk about overtraining a little bit as a very particular type of chronic stress in the athlete populations that we work with from time to time. So let me give you the definition of it, right? And I'll make a comment after I read through this. It's the accumulation of training and or non-training stress, resulting in a short or long-term decrement in performance capacity, with or without related physiological or psychological signs or symptoms of overtraining, in which restoration of performance capacity may take several days, weeks, or months to get yourself out of that, right? Wide open definition, right? It's one of those things where, how many people work with athletes who are at risk for overtraining, just by a show of hands? Okay, it's one of those things where you don't really need a definition because you know it when you see it, right? There's a whole body of literature around diagnosing overtraining. And one of the problems with it is once you get it, once you can point to it, you're screwed. It's too late. Now you have to either have a long rest, you have to have a complete overhaul of nutrition or an overhaul of their training regimen. So wouldn't it be great if we could find overtraining before it happens, right? Wouldn't it be great if we had, you know, signals that we could pick out that led us to believe this athlete is on a track that they shouldn't be on? And so, as I said before, if you have access to some of the biochemical measurements, that's a great way to go. But some of these psychological measurements, I think, can fill in for that out in the field. So lots of things. I won't go through all of these. All these individual bullet points, because I want to get to some data, but to show that there are a lot of things that can factor in. I think we sometimes forget that our athletes are people too, right? The athletic stress that they have, you know, psychological stress of competing and worrying about their competitors, the stress of their schoolwork, if they're students, the stress of their jobs, if they're out of school and they're working to support their athletic training. They still have the same stressors that everybody else has. They still have the same exposure or the same potential to be exposed to chronic stressors that we see in the general population. And then on top of that, we're adding their physical stressors of their training and their traveling and whatever their dietary regimens are. So, even though in one part of my life I'm a physiologist, most of the work that I do is nutrition. So we tease the physiology people sometimes and say there's no such thing as overtraining. There's only under eating, right? That you can withstand any load of training as long as you're periodizing your eating to that. And big parts of it are making sure you're eating the right kind of a diet from an antioxidant perspective, the right kind of diet from an inflammatory perspective. And there's lots of ways to graphically represent this, right? We all know that as our training volume or intensity, as we train more, our performance gets better, up to a point, right? There's a tipping point. Goodness gracious. There's a tipping point where, you know, too much of that is gonna start resulting in some of these problems, right? Higher injury rates, higher infection rates, higher risks of some of the things I've talked about before, those psychological changes, depression and mental changes. Lots of different ways to represent this, either as an inverted U or as a seesaw sort of a thing. But if we match the diet to that training regimen, we can prevent some of these detrimental things. So I'm not a big grams per kilogram kind of a nutritionist. And I do that because, at least the athletes that I've worked with will look at something like, you know, you should eat, you know, 2 grams of carbohydrate per kilogram of body weight in this phase of your training. And then when you go to this phase of your training, you need to change it to 5 grams. And athletes don't eat grams, right? They want to eat real food. And that can change hugely over time. Here's an example of a 165-pound Ironman triathlete. Look at the huge change just in caloric requirements over the course of a season, right? Trying to you know, get down to fighting weight, they're down around, you know, around 1,800 calories, 2,400 calories during off-season weight maintenance. But during the peak of the season, where they're really killing it in terms of their workouts, they're up around 3,000. And sometimes, you know, if they're doing a big buildup, that's not even the tip of the iceberg in terms of what they need. So, you know, I'll show you in just a little bit a way that we work with some of the athletes and the general public to show them how to get that grams of protein, grams of carbohydrate, grams of fat without counting anything, right? We use the hand as a portion control device. Let me just make a couple of quick. I don't want to sound anti-supplement because I'm very pro-supplement in certain areas, but I do think that athletes get a message sometimes that because they're under these unique stressors that the average person isn't under, that their bodies have an increased energy turnover, but maybe not. They have a higher micronutrient turnover, right? So because they're eating more food, they're getting more micronutrients. They might not need to supplement all the time. Incidentally, I feel that they do, but to what degree is the question. They might have increased needs because of tissue repair. They might have increased needs because they're under oxidative stress, you know, 30, 40, 50 times resting levels. They might have an increased susceptibility for illness or injury because of some of the biochemical changes that I mentioned before. But it's a question mark in certain areas. I think in some areas it's an exclamation point. Yes, they have increased needs, but in some areas it's a question mark. So some of the ones that we know, some of the specific subsets of athletes that we know do have these increased needs. If you have some sort of disordered eating, eating or you're following a weird diet. Endurance athletes, especially the ultra, stereotypical ultra athletes, are eating lots and lots and lots of carbs, and they might be displacing other sources of nutrition. And then poor dietary choices. Even in the highest level elite athletes, there still is a woeful lack of fruit and vegetables, a woeful lack of whole grains. They sort of intellectually know. The general population intellectually knows that they should be eating more fruits and vegetables than they are now. Does anyone know in the general population what the average fruit and vegetable intake is every day? In terms of number of servings?
Two.
Yeah, 1.8. Yeah, when it depending on which organization you look at, it should be, 5 or 10 or 14. It's not even scratching the surface. So, the way we eat can get us into this cycle that leads us to whether you want to say chronic stress or you want to say overtraining. And our training programs can be a direct contributor to that, right? The stress of intense training on a short term can decrease appetite. Tour de France riders are a great example of athletes that have a huge caloric need, but because they just got off the bike, they might not be hungry for a few hours, and then they need to get their sleep, and they can't eat while they're sleeping. So that suppression of appetite can be a big problem for them getting in the nutrients that they need. Over the long term, though, when these athletes are chronically stressed, their appetite very likely will increase, and will increase specifically for foods that they probably shouldn't be eating, cupcakes and junk foods and things like that. So you see changes in food intake, typically reduced nutrient availability, not the right direction. Then you have these problems where the tissues are not going to function. You have a functional impairment of the tissues. Reduced glycogen, elevated free radicals, elevated inflammatory cytokines. So that functional impairment eventually results in some sort of a structural impairment. That's where the catabolism starts to happen in here, where we actually start to get tissue breakdown, tissue damage, slower recovery, increased risk for injury and illness, and then some of these sort of systemic changes that we can measure. So I want to shift gears just a little bit and talk specifically about oxidation and inflammation, right? One of the ideas that I try to get across when we talk about oxidation to athletes is that there's this metabolism going on. There's this furnace burning in your body, and you have to feed that. So I won't spend too much time on the definition of free radicals versus antioxidants. I think everybody in here is going to have a very good understanding of that. What I do want to get across is that, you get too much free radical damage, that's going to be a problem at the cellular level, at the tissue level, at the organ level, at the system level. But we should start thinking about, and here's where, very, very good studies, long-term studies have shown that, when that's out of balance to a significant degree for a significant period of time, we're going to get problems. We're going to get problems in muscles and bones and joints and ligaments and tendons. And so we need to fight that with antioxidants from our diet, antioxidants from our supplements. But to what degree? Right? Our bodies are pretty good at upregulating their production of our own endogenous antioxidant enzyme systems, superoxide dismutase, glutathione peroxidase. Those go up to a pretty significant degree with our training, but do they go up enough? I think there's still a certain amount of debate here. We need those to protect our cell membranes, to protect our nuclear membranes, to protect our mitochondrial membranes from that damage. But do athletes have that much greater needs? Do they need to be supplementing with 400 IUs of vitamin E or 1,000 or more than that? Do they need to be supplementing with 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C? Do they need to be supplementing with all these different things? I think probably not. Here's some of those enzyme systems. Here's vitamin E, lipid-soluble, vitamin C, water-soluble, carotenoids, yellow and orange fruits, flavonoids, blue and purple foods. The point that I want to make about these is that, first of all, there can be some negative implications of megadosing. a raft of studies have come out in the last 5 years showing that if you do megadose, it can cause tissue damage instead of prevent tissue damage that you're looking prevent. It can cause oxidative stress instead of prevent oxidative stress. It can impair contractile function. It can impair adaptations to the training that you're putting your body through. So there's definitely a fine balance there, and I think it's because of this, right? We have to remember that the antioxidant network is a network, right? And so the studies that are showing the biggest degree of problem tend to be the studies that are using the highest doses of isolated antioxidants. Studies where you're using a big dose of just alpha tocopherol, or a big dose of just ascorbic acid, or a big dose of just beta carotene. So those are the studies where there's a clear problem. Don't do that. At the other end of the scale, there are the studies that show, hey, if you get these in a food format, lots of brightly colored fruits and vegetables, you know, through small levels throughout, you know, many, many years, that seems to be, yes, you know, no-brainer, that's a good thing to do. The in-between is still kind of a gray area. So here's a little more simplified view of the antioxidant network. But the reason why it's important, I think, to get this across to athletes is so that they don't run out and say, oh, I read something in my magazine or the newspaper about how free radicals are bad and antioxidants are good, and I'm going to go to the drugstore and I'm going to get a big whopping dose of vitamin E or beta carotene or C or any of these, right? They all work with each other, and probably best, we know this for flavonoids, for example, they're much better absorbed at low levels taken for a long period of time versus absorption of big bolus doses is much prevented. Probably the body is smart trying to do that kind of thing. So antioxidants are a network strategy. Inflammatory cascades are also a network strategy. So the fact that we can just, you know, I'm a big fan of fish oil, so don't take this like I'm trying to bash fish oil, but, you know, we look at inflammation and say, oh, well, the solution for inflammation in the body is to take this one thing. Now, I think if we think on it more holistically and think about, okay, how can we, you know, get to this part of the inflammatory cascade and this part and this part and this part, similar to that idea of the antioxidant network, using small amounts of several different triggers at the same time to get an overall better effect, that's where we're going to get the best benefit and the lowest risk of side effects. And so how do we do that? Aha, we do it with nutrition. Right, we do it with supplements that are blended and balanced in the appropriate ways. So I was in Malaysia last month. I got to visit some of the palm fruit plantations to see this fruit, which I wasn't so familiar with until I went there and talked to some of the scientists there. But this is an example of nature's packaging of all of this into the same kind of a blend, right? So here this little fruit, you've got anti-inflammatory fatty acids, you've got carotenoids and polyphenols, flavonoids, that work against different free radicals in different parts of the body. You've got tocopherols and tocotrienols, not very high in the tocopherols, but very high in tocotrienols, which work in different parts of the body because there are fat-soluble ones and water-soluble ones. You've got phytosterols. You've got this mix of stuff that's going to work in several places at the same time on several different aspects of that biochemical stress. You know, so we can say the same thing for, you know, the company that I work for, Monavie, does a lot of acai juices, right? There's some lipid-soluble flavonoids. There's some water-soluble flavonoids. You know, you can point around nature and show this kind of a system effect, a network effect across almost everything that you look at. So I think we need to maybe go back to that sometimes instead of looking at one isolated compound. This is one way. We were talking just before about how do we talk to consumers about or athletes. How do we talk to non-scientists about any of this stuff, right? Inflammation's kind of complicated. Antioxidants are kind of complicated. One of the reasons they're complicated is because you can't see it. You can't touch it. You can't pick up a free radical and see what it's made of and see that it's dangerous for you, right? This is something that we're trying to do with the company where we've got a little device where you put your finger into it and it measures carotenoid and flavonoid levels in the skin. And it gives you a sort of a broad indication of your overall antioxidant protection, at least from those two classes of of antioxidants. So here's how we tell our athletes to eat. And here's how we tell the people who come into our stress studies to eat. Instead of telling them grams per kilogram of body weight, we use what we call the helping hand, right? So this is their hand is their fruits and vegetables, right? That's how much it takes up on their, not five servings, how much space it takes up on their plate. So, you know, if you think about a plate in front of you, that's going to take up about half your plate. Right? People sometimes say, can I have two? Can I have two hands worth of fruits and vegetables? And we say, of course you can. Your lean protein is the size of your palm. Your concentrated carbs, starches, you know, rice and bread and cereals and things like that are about the size of your fist. Added fat is about the size of the circle that your index finger and thumb make when you make an OK sign. And then metabolic controllers. We're very often saying, eat this way, and we're studying this particular supplement, this herb or this blend. That, for most people, is about 500 calories, right? So we'll have them track. We'll have them do a three-day diet record where we'll actually enter it, and we'll show them, look, this meal was 437 calories. This one was 520 calories. On average, across the whole 3 days, it comes in at about 500 calories a meal. So we can give that to them however many times they need it in a particular day. And their meals end up looking like this. We try to get them to eat brightly colored fruits and vegetables to get those high antioxidant levels. So all of the studies I'm going to present to you just now, I want to share with you several graphs about some of the data where we've had people eat that way, and then all we've changed in any of the studies that I'm going to show you is the supplement, whatever the balancing supplement is. We follow them for generally 8 weeks, sometimes 12 weeks, sometimes a little longer if it's a weight loss indication. But it's around this idea of trying to control their sources of stress in several different perspectives at the same time. So we have them eat that way, we change the supplement, but the rest of it we keep pretty consistent. Some of the supplements we've studied over the last years would broadly fall in. Sometimes I'll put this up and someone will go, oh, adaptogens, right? People familiar with that term? Right, so ginseng is a classic adaptogen. Cordyceps is a classic adaptogen. In these cultures, whether it's Malaysian medicine, Chinese medicine, Tibetan medicine, also Tibetan medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, Chinese medicine, these are all in a broad category of rebalancer kinds of supplements. They're intended to maintain metabolic balance. In those cultures, they're not. They're intended to improve prana or improve chi or improve the life force or whatever. We're trying to use it in a modern setting to try to balance the stressors that either athletes or dieters or sleep-deprived people feel. So here's one where we actually didn't use any of those. We used a branched-chain amino acid blend. So here's the blend in this supplement. Branched-chain amino acids, glutamine, proteolytic enzymes, and a few antioxidants. Placebo group, this supplement's called Recoveries. What we showed was a huge change in mood state parameters, where significant changes in tension, fatigue, confusion, vigor, global mood state, just from taking a dietary supplement, probably because what these nutrients were enabling the body to do is, well, obviously, fight free radicals, fight inflammation. The branched-chain amino acid part of it, the immune system cells use those as a source of fuel to go in and, you know, heal up some of that damage. So that's one aspect of it. These were athletes post-marathon, so they had a lot of lung damage. They had a lot of muscular damage, they had a lot of post-exercise muscle soreness, they had a lot of upper respiratory tract infection symptoms, and so those kinds of supplements were able to not just help them feel better in terms of muscle soreness and upper respiratory symptoms, but feel better psychologically. This I wanted to put up as sort of a summary slide. What we generally find is the degree of change in cortisol to testosterone ratio is very similar to the degree of change in subjective stress indications and very similar to the degree of change in global mood state. So global mood state is kind of like a quality of life parameter. How are you feeling overall in general for the last 2 weeks? They all change about the same magnitude. So that, and this has been something consistent over the last 10 years, that these three pieces of data change about the same magnitude if they change. They don't always change, but when they do, they change about the same. So that tells me that if you don't have access to the biochemistry, you can use something like profile of mood states, or you can use an even shorter, this is 64 questions, this is 10 questions, to get a quick snapshot on what those athletes might be feeling like. Here's a study from, this is after an Ironman event, where profile of mood states were changing after a supplementation intervention. Improvement on global mood state, a drop is a better global mood state. It's kind of opposite of what you might think, but a 20% improvement, very, very similar to the change in cortisol levels. So these athletes were clearly under less stress in this situation. They clearly felt better. One of the things I like about the profile of mood states survey, if you haven't used it before, is that you can subdivide the different classes and really get a perspective for why these athletes or why these subjects are feeling the way they're feeling. And so two of the most important, three of the most important, the ones that we love to look at are the depression subscale. So this isn't measuring depression, the disease. It's just named depression. It's a sort of a, their mental outlook. This will change dramatically. In this particular study, we showed a halving, a 50% reduction. Fatigue is very responsive, and vigor is very responsive. In the kinds of studies that we do, in this study, we did see a change in anger, we did see a change in confusion, we did see a change in tension, but we don't always see those. Those are really more, sort of life state kinds of things that might not necessarily change in response to the physiological changes that we're inducing in the kinds of studies that we're doing. So here's a study that we looked at the interaction between using an inflammatory controller, a flavonoid supplement, and using an anti-stress product. This was a combination of uricoma root and theanine. And what we found was, I'm only showing you the combined data, but we found when we combined the two, the inflammatory controller and the stress controller, we got this gigantic drop in high sensitivity CRP, C-reactive peptide, sort of a systemic indication of overall body inflammation. In just the inflammatory group, we saw something around 30%, 35%. So still a very good effect, but more than a doubling. It was about a tripling of an effect on the inflammation, telling us that if you control inflammation and stress at the same time, you get a synergistic effect on inflammation. Similar when we looked at their catabolic index, free androgen index divided by 24-hour cortisol, we showed a huge improvement in the body's ability to repair the damage that they were under compared to when we looked at either supplement alone. So, we're seeing this in the biochemistry. We're seeing that translated into the psychology. So that same study, those same supplements, vigor is improved 27%. Tension is reduced 34%. We didn't see changes in things like I mentioned before. We didn't see changes in things like anger and irritability and things like that. But clearly, the biochemistry was changing. We can document that. The psychology is changing. We can document that. What we'd love to do in some of the future studies is then go one more step and see, do these athletes perform better? It makes sense that they would, but for people who do performance studies, how difficult they can be sometimes. So here's a study where we look at uricoma longifolia. You guys might know this as Tongkat Ali or Malaysian ginseng in the supplement world. We looked at 24-hour mountain bike racers. We showed that the uricoma group had a huge reduction in salivary cortisol levels, so clearly they were under less stress. They had a big change in free testosterone levels, salivary testosterone levels, so their ratio was in a superior place. Branched-chain amino acids do some of the same kinds of things. Again, 24-hour mountain bike racers. Whether we gave a low dose or a high dose of branched-chain amino acids, we were seeing drops in cortisols. And then, very recent study, we just published the uricoma data in the JISSN, and we've submitted the magnolia data. But in our magnolia bark group, huge drop in cortisol. in our uricoma group a huge increase in free testosterone. So that tells us a couple of things that I've sort of alluded to already, that if we change that biochemistry, take them out of an imbalanced state where their vigor's low and their performance is likely to be low, and put them back to a normal vigor or a high vigor state, we've got the potential to improve their performance. How big of a change is this? This, I think, is a good statistic. The magnitude effect change that we're seeing with our global mood state and our vigor data is about 20%, 30%, in that range. That's about the same magnitude change you see with pharmaceutical treatments, Prozacs and Zolofts and those sorts of things, in this kind of a population. So, you know, moral of the story, biochemical balance enhances weight loss. We get a metabolic effect. There's a behavioral effect. It can improve compliance. And what you can't see down here is that there can be a psychological effect. And that's what I've been talking about. These athletes feel better. If they feel better, they're going to be more compliant. Hopefully, their performance is going to be better. So that, I think, is my last slide. Thanks a lot for your attention, you guys. I know we've got a break now, but I can answer some questions.
Yeah. The next presentation will be starting right now at 3:50, but if you want to ask a question, Dr. Talbot will be here at the end of those.
Thanks.
Last presentation is at 3:50, and it's going to be right now.